Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. House recently passed a bill that could lock in the right to marry for same-sex, interracial, and other couples. We talk about the bill's chances in the Senate and what exactly it would protect if passed. First, the English language can be strange with a lot of rules, but just as many exceptions. There are silent letters, unexpected sounds, and expressions that don't make a lot of sense when you really think about them. Our next guest wanted to know why noses run and feet smell, why of isn't spelled with a V, and why the British put a U in the word color. So she wrote a book about it. We're listening back to our conversation about those quirks of the English language, and we want to hear from you. What weird English language rules stand out to you? What words do you think are spelled weird or pronounced in unexpected ways? If English isn't your first language, what parts were the hardest for you to learn? What parts make the least sense to you? Email centraltime at WPR.org. That's centraltime at WPR.org, and let us know what you think. Erica Okrent is a linguist and author of the new book, Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. We talked with her earlier this summer. Before we dig into some of the big picture stuff, let's start with one example that illustrates a lot of it right out of the title of your book. Tough, through, dough, throw in a hiccup and some others there. O-U-G-H, why don't all words with that letter cluster rhyme?
Yeah, they look the same. It seems like they should sound the same, but we have just a mess of different pronunciations. Sometimes it's an F, like a cough, or sometimes it's not pronounced at all. The vowels are all different. And the reason, as with most weird things about English, is history and the unusual history of the language. That GH there in those words, we used to pronounce. It's an old sound that English doesn't have anymore. That's sort of like a ch sound, a blech sound. And if you look at some words in German and their English counterparts, you can see like night, Nacht, light, Licht, neighbor, Nachbar. That's still in German, and they go back, both German and English, go way back to the same distant ancestor. So we had that sound, and we had it long enough to get it into the writing, but we didn't keep it, and now it shifted and changed in various ways, giving us all kinds of different pronunciations, but not before it got settled in the writing.
And it got settled in different ways, because as you mentioned, sometimes that sound turned into an F. Sometimes it disappeared altogether. So maybe that town over there won on dough and that town over there won on tough.
Yeah. And sometimes there's still two. So we have dough, but there's in England, there's a dessert called plum duff that they eat at Christmas time. And that's the same word. They say duff. And it went on to that usage, but in other places it became dough. So yeah, just to make it more confusing.
And this example illustrates the main theme of your book, that we can look at English in 2022 and say, yeah, it's just English, it's weird, and there aren't any rules. But all of this stuff comes out of a long history, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not random. It feels like it's very random and unexplainable. It's not random and it's not unexplainable, but that doesn't mean it's logical. So things change in one place, but not in another. Things change at one point in history, and that leaves lumps and bumps that don't get changed later. So we can explain it, but sometimes it's a pretty involved explanation. But it is there, and we don't have to feel like it's just crazy. It doesn't make any sense. Well, it doesn't make any sense, but there's a reason for it.
Now, we asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page for some of their examples, and the first one we got is the first one you tackle in the book. Ted just had a one-word answer to our question, colonel, like the rank in the army, C-O-L-O-N-E-L. There's not an R in sight, and we say colonel, and that's got a trilingual story you write in the book.
Yeah, how do you spell this word? How do you say this word? They don't match at all, but they did at one time. When we first got the word colonel, we borrowed it from French, who at that time said coronel, so we took coronel, and we dropped some syllables from coronel to colonel. That's a very typical thing that happens in language change. But then in the, you know, the 15th, 1600s, people went back to the source of these words, which was Italian, and started reading these old Italian military treatises. And they said, ah, colonel, that's what it was in Italian. French had changed the L to the R in coronel. So we looked at that, those old texts, and said, oh, well, it's properly, it should be colonel. And if you were educated and wanted to show that you were educated, you started writing it colonel. And French actually changed, they say colonel now, but we kept saying colonel, but while writing it colonel. And some people tried to change the pronunciation, but it's much harder to change how people speak than it is to change how they write, because it's a certain class of people are doing the writing and they get to make the decisions for the writing, but they can't necessarily say, okay, everyone, you know, now we're going to pronounce it this way. And so we're lucky we get both. We get the whole range.
We're talking to Erica Okrent, a linguist, author of the new book, Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. You can join in with your own examples. What are the things that stand out to you as weird in the way we spell or say words in English? Do you have a question for our guest about why these things happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, we got into that early Germanic stuff. We've borrowed one from the French. Those are two big sections of your book. You just mentioned written English, and a thing that locked in a lot of weirdnesses is the invention of the printing press. What happened?
Yeah, the printing press made it easier to produce written texts in English. Written texts were being produced before then, but at the time it was, you know, 1476, that's when it came to England. And English was in kind of a transition at that point because it had stopped being a written language for a few hundred years after the French takeover. People were still speaking English, but the writing was in French and or in Latin. It was controlled by the class of people who do the writing, and they were not speaking English. They were doing French or Latin. So English is starting to become a written language again, and how we, it's very different now. How do we spell things? How do we write things? The language is not the same as it was when we had a writing system of old English. So it's up in flux, it's changing. Meanwhile, the printing press is doing great. People love having the ability to print out things and spread them around, but nobody's doing it consistently. There's no such thing as a dictionary. There's no such thing as an editor or a book of here's our house style. Everyone's winging it, doing different things based on their pronunciation, based on what they've seen before. And it's all spreading around really fast now because we can produce the texts so much faster. So that period of time, it was really unlucky that the time when the printing press came, the language wasn't in a position to be settled. It was very much in flux. And so it settled in this way, in that way, in that place, in all kinds of different ways. And now we're stuck with the results because you can't change it now.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Madison. Laura, hi. Are you there, Laura?
Hi, I'm here. I was wondering what the difference was between awesome and awful. Why, if there's some awe, why wouldn't it be full of awe? And awful means something completely different. Thank you.
Interesting, Laura. Thanks, Erica.
Yeah, that's a very typical thing we do in English and other languages too. We have sort of opposite meaning words from the same root. So we, awful is bad and awesome is good. We have, terrible is bad and terrific is good, but those both come from terror. And it's kind of similar to awe because awe was fear. That's something you tremble with awe before a great power. And that to be awful would to be sort of having this feeling of fear, trembling before power. So how do we get from that to awesome? Well, fear, we like to use fear to intensify what we're trying to say. So when words get a little stale or a little boring, we don't want to say, oh, that was, you know, that was a really good performance. We want to say, oh, that was frightfully good, which was, you know, that was popular a few decades ago. But another way to do that is to say it was, you know, it was awesome. Like, it was so good. It was scary good. You know, that's something we do now. We use fear to intensify the positive emotion we want to express. And we have a few vocabulary items that are, that have made that flip back and forth. Fear is a really great way to freshen up your vocabulary when it's starting to get boring and stale.
We're having an awfully good conversation with linguist Erica Okrand about her latest book, Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. You can share your favorites or confusions at 800-642-1234. What English pronunciations and or spelling strike you as odd? Do you wonder why certain words look the way they do? What are your favorite or least favorite quirks of this English language? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with linguist Erica Okrent. Her latest book is called Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the origins of certain strangenesses in the English language, the way we spell and pronounce and say stuff. Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Anne is with us in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. So I teach preschool and kindergarten, and we don't really worry about spelling at this age. It's not the most important thing at all. But the children who are ready for spelling are so confused. They're like, they see this O-U-G-H, and they see enough and through, and they're just like, what? Why?
What do you tell them, Anne, when they ask you why?
I basically say what the author said at the very beginning. I say, English is weird, you know, and sometimes I give little hints towards, you know, oh, we our language comes from several other languages. But, you know, it's a pretty complex topic for a five-year-old.
Yeah.
And so I was really wondering, though, I had read this study that said that there are languages that are orthographically simple, whereas ours has orthographic complexity, which basically means weird spellings, mm-hmm. as far as I understand it. And that our language and languages with this complexity take like 3 years longer for children to learn to write.
Interesting. And thanks for the call. And I know, Erica, I try and fail to learn Spanish. And the letter, one thing I like is the letters. You see that letter? It's always going to be said the same pretty much. Is English orthographically complex, like Anne said? Does it make it harder to learn to spell?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's not as hard to learn to spell or to write as Mandarin or something. That takes a lot longer. But of all the languages that use the Latin alphabet, English is the most confusing because the Latin alphabet and its adoption happened at more convenient times in other languages, either after they had already gone through major changes or before. So it might be inconsistent, like French has a lot of, you know, rules you have to learn, but you can fit them all on a few pages and they're pretty consistent. You know, but Polish looks very complex to us, but it's very simple. You can put all the rules on a page and know how to pronounce it. And most languages that use the Latin alphabet are like that. But no, English to list all of its exceptions and rules takes about 450 pages. That's the most complete explanation of English spelling is ridiculous that way. So yeah, it is. Learning to read and write English is a lot more difficult than it is in other languages because of that, the bad timing of the printing press, which is when things get settled. How do we spell this? What's our habit? That happened over the course of a couple hundred years, but at a very bad time when the language was really changing. The whole vowel system was changing. English had not been written that much before. So it was a bad stroke of bad luck for English writing.
Thanks for the call. And we'll go to Marie now in Eau Claire. Marie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Marie?
Hey, I just was going to coattail on that comment. I'm just wondering, I know the printing press was invented a long time ago, but I'm wondering why there can't be a few spelling changes a year. You know, we have a few new words a year. There's a couple of words that would be so helpful if we could change them. I'm a reading tutor, especially silent letters. Couldn't we all agree on 5 or 10 a year that we drop the G in knife or we drop the G in gnome? That would just make it easier for everyone. Is there a reason we can't have a consensus to make these type of progressive changes?
Marie, thanks for that call. Actually, it's even worse than that, Erica. If I remember correctly, when we were trying to standardize English, we actually added in some silent letters because people thought it'd be more consistent, like O-U-G-H has got added where they hadn't been before.
Yeah. Sometimes like the word haughty is didn't originally have that G-H in there, but it seemed to look better. And we do and have made decisions based on the look of words. So like the word could did not have an L in it. But should and would did, because those come from shall and will. So there's a reason for the L in should and would. Could comes from can. There was no reason for there to be an L, but it fits together with those two other words. They're similar in function. They're similar in form. It just evened out the little paradigm there to put the L in. So yeah, that's sort of the opposite of what you're saying. Putting in words, putting in letters where they never were and shouldn't be is something we've also done. But people have tried. They have tried over and over again to simplify English spelling. Many proposals have been put out. Many people have, you know, they've created a whole journal written in simple English or whatever their system is. And the problem is that it just looks too funny. It's sort of like when you see one of those meme, like Iken has cheeseburger type writing. If you see a lot of text in simplified English, it looks funny to us. And it's even harder to read for people who have already become literate. Now, if you're just learning to read, it would make sense. But it's kind of too late. We have too much of a habit already established so that if we try to simplify too much, it actually becomes harder to recognize the word fast enough because we don't sound things out so much when we're reading, unless it's an unfamiliar word. We recognize. So it's the balance between the people who already know it and the people who are trying to learn it. And it's really hard to make the change for the benefit of the people who are trying to learn it when there are so many people who just have the habit already.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Erica Okrent. Her new book is called Highly Irregular. It's about the weirdnesses of the English language, how they got there. Back to your calls. Fawn is with us in Madison. Hi, Fawn.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on that same topic. My godfather, my late godfather, John Malone, he invented an alternate orthography for English where there was one letter for each phoneme, for each sound that's in the English language, and one letter per sound. He called it unifon, U-N-I-F-O-N. So there wouldn't be those irregularities of Q-U. That would be K-W or, you know, the rest that you're describing. And it's like, it's as you said, those things never catch on. Like Hooked on Phonics, that can't be turned into our regular everyday spelling because people are too attached to the old traditions, I guess you could say. But it's a shame, really, because given that English is de facto the world's universal language, lingua franca, as it were, universal language, people from all over the globe shouldn't have to learn this convoluted and tortured spelling just to communicate with each other. And so what you're describing is that, as you're saying, that English is, in essence, part phonetic but part ideograms in the wake of the word, and you recognize the meaning even before you recognize the, or at the same time as you recognize the.
Gotcha. Fawn, we don't have too much time left. Looks like 40 letters in that Unifon system. Erica, the tricky thing here is trying to change language in any way by doing it on purpose.
Yeah, this is, language is, it's a part of nature. It's a human behavior, and it's not amenable to control from above. So, invent a new language that has no irregularities and perfect match between meaning and form. You can spend your lifetime inventing that, but that has nothing to do with if you make it perfect, but how will you get people to use it? That's the part that just, it doesn't follow. It's very hard to make people change their language from above with some kind of system, no matter how perfect the system is. But it's also, perfect is in the eye of the beholder, and everybody who's created these has come up with a different way of doing it. And also, if you're doing it for spelling, it's based on your pronunciation, which differs from other people's. You know, people have accents, people pronounce vowels differently, people do or do not pronounce certain letters in different places. And so who's gets to be the official version? That's always going to come up when you're trying to create a perfect spelling.
Erica Okrent is a linguist and author of the book Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme and Other Oddities of the English Language. We listened back to our conversation from earlier this year. You can still let us know about your favorite or least favorite quirks of the English language or things that never made sense to you. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. After the news, a new bill that's passed the House would effectively repeal a 25-year-old law known as the Defense of Marriage Act and protect same-sex marriage if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns past rulings. We'll talk about the bill and where it's headed in the Senate. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the State Consumer Protection Administrator about a rising threat of cyber attacks and what we can do to protect our personal information. Now, the Respect for Marriage Act passed in the U.S. House last week. It would write into federal law the right to marry for same-sex and interracial couples. Here's Wisconsin Representative and co-sponsor of the bill, Mark Pocan, speaking on the floor of the House.
Here's what I want. I want to make sure that my husband, Phil, can visit me in the hospital should I have to go back again, like when I had a triple bypass a few years ago. I want to make sure my husband has my earned benefits for retirement and Social Security. I want to make sure that my husband is taken care of just like your spouses are taken care of. If I was the entity on the other side of the aisle, I'd be more concerned when my own members accuse it of having cocaine-fueled orgies than worrying about the morality of my marriage. I yield back.
There's a similarly named bill in the U.S. Senate where Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin says she's working directly with Republicans to try to find enough votes to prevent a filibuster and pass it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this push in Congress to put into law marriage rights for same-sex couples in particular? This would also include interracial couples. How high a priority is this for you? Do you worry that the U.S. Supreme Court would overrule past decisions of the Supreme Court that allowed same-sex marriage in states around the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kimmy King is interim chair and distinguished teaching professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
Let's set the stage a little bit here. This all kind of starts with the Supreme Court and the Roe v. Wade decision, overturning the Roe v. Wade precedent. Why did that get people in Congress talking about same-sex marriage?
The big reason why it did is because Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion, went even further than what the court had said in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. That's the case that said, in terms of an abortion, there isn't a substantive due process right there. It needs to go back to the states. And so we go back to this patchwork that is our system of federalism. And it's because Thomas said, look, here we're saying there's not a fundamental right to abortion. And the majority opinion is not saying what I'm going to say, which is it raises the specter that once we overturn this substantive due process right, there are other rights that should be looked at, like the right to marital contraception, the right to marriage equality. And so it's from that that you are seeing this push to prevent the court from doing what they did in Dobbs.
Now, there is a federal law related to same-sex marriage on the books in the 1990s, the Defense of Marriage Act. This goes back to the Clinton administration. Can you remind us what that act did?
Yeah, so the Respect for Marriage Act would, in essence, repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, which is a 1996 law backed by Clinton that defined marriage for federal purposes as a union between one man and one woman. And so it was to address that patchwork of marriage laws to make it clear what the rule of law ought to be.
If this Respect for Marriage Act passes, as more or less written in the House, what exactly does it do, apart from, as you say, repealing the Defense of Marriage Act?
Yeah, so it at least provides some federal ground for LGBTQ rights. You also have to remember that the Supreme Court has actually said that there are LGBTQ rights in employment law under the Civil Rights Act. So it's interesting that the Supreme Court has recognized LGBTQ rights in that context. It's in this issue of marriage equality that there becomes this concern. And so all it would do would be to provide a firm federal stance on it, recognize that the Supreme Court has the ability to weigh in on laws. Most certainly the law would be challenged because in this kind of polarized environment, everything is being challenged.
We're talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, political scientist there, looking at an effort in Congress to pass a Respect for Marriage Act. It's passed the House, supported by Democrats, some Republicans there. Now the Senate, open question, what's going to end up happening there? Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Hello there. Hopefully you still have me. I love what Congress is trying to do and the Senate, but what is going on with our Supreme Court that it's like they're going backwards. Instead of trying to help people, they're trying to destroy. I don't get it. What is the thought process there?
Pat, thanks for the call. Kimmy, Pat worried that the U.S. Supreme Court has kind of reversed course over the last few years.
Well, and the question I think that Pat is also getting at that's implied is what does it mean for a whole other set of laws? Recall that the civil rights movement really began pushing in the 30s, 40s, but started to have success in the 50s, and then especially in the 60s with things like voting rights. And so one of the comments that's been made, and there is a case before the court next fall, which will be looking at voting rights and would return greater power to the states over voting rights. And that's the reason why we have the 1965 Voting Rights Act in the first place. I mean, some have commented that this year it's 1973 out of the Supreme Court, and next year it'll be 1963. The argument that I think the conservative justices might try to make is that we are using originalism and we are trying to look at what the Constitution said. And it fundamentally boils down to this view of whether you see the Constitution as a document that evolves in terms of granting more rights, or whether that if you want to grant more of those rights, the legislatures have to make it explicit and they have to set it down, because Congress could have solved this issue back in 1974. In fact, in the days after Roe v. Wade was decided, there was a push to try to codify it. And over time, there have been attempts to do it, but they didn't do it. the Congress didn't have the political will. It'll be curious to see whether they have the political will in this case. They got 47 Republicans on board. That's a lot more than they did last year when they were trying to provide for additional LGBTQ rights.
Thanks for that call, Pat. One common argument from Republicans opposed to putting this law into place, some have head on said, you know, they don't support same-sex marriage, but some have said, we're not worried about same-sex marriage, but we're not worried about the Supreme Court overturning its same-sex marriage ruling. So you shouldn't either. This is just a distraction. Not going to happen. People supporting the law said, well, wait a minute. We thought Roe v. Wade was settled law, and that wasn't going to happen either. What do you think about that argument that it's kind of an unnecessary sideshow?
Yeah, the reality is that in 1989, Justice Scalia wrote in a concurring opinion regarding a decision that what the court was doing was they were setting the groundwork, and that someday we would look back at that 1989 decision and say Roe v. Wade has been effectively overruled. And nobody listened to Scalia then. And the result is where we find ourselves today with the Dobbs decision. You just can't know who's going to wind up on the court. Nobody would have predicted that President Trump was going to have the opportunity to put on three justices. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg recognized back in the 1970s that the abortion rights were fragile, especially because of the state situation. And there are some who are arguing that, you know, God bless her, RBG Ginsburg should have stepped down sooner because that might have made a difference here. But instead, she held on. And it's those three justices that have been put on that have made the difference.
We're talking about proposed legislation working its way through Congress aimed at putting into law marriage equality for same-sex and interracial couples, those protected currently by Supreme Court decisions. But what happens if the Supreme Court reverses those decisions? Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress, the House already did it, the Senate maybe, do you want to see the Senate pass a bill like this saying, yes, same-sex marriage is legal here in the United States? Do you agree with what we've heard from Republicans, that this is just a sideshow, that this isn't something that's likely to happen, overturning Roe v. Wade? Do you have wider questions about the idea of privacy rights and whether they are real rights, something that should be taken seriously by courts? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Kimmy King from the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas, looking at the Respect for Marriage bill in Congress aimed at protecting same-sex marriage in the event of a Supreme Court reversal of past rulings. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hi. I'm looking at what Tony Barrett said. She's an originalist, meaning the original way the Constitution was written. And interracial marriage was not written into the Constitution. If she stays with that, and Thomas, who also used that for turning over Roe Wade, then Thomas has to divorce his white wife. That's illegal, and women's rights were not in the Constitution, so she has to leave the Supreme Court because that's illegal. So originalists, and this is going on. So it's kind of like they're writing their own demise if they use the same premise of what overturned Roe Wade. So what Congress is pushing through, yeah, that should have been through a long time ago. I definitely support that.
Bill,
rights for marriage.
Thanks a lot for the call. Kimmy, Bill saying, where does originalism stop?
So I think one of the things that's interesting that your caller is pointing out is that this is part of the debate about originalism. Now, what, again, the conservative justices would say to you was that there are these fundamental freedoms that we have. And the question is, what constitutes a fundamental freedom? And so the right to, I think the interesting point about interracial marriage and certainly women being able to serve on the courts. In fact, there's a decision from the late 1800s that said that women were too gentle. Their nature did not allow them to serve in the courts. And so they were denied being able to have access to that kind of participation. It really fundamentally boils down to how you view the Constitution and those fundamental freedoms. And we go back to this idea of the role of the states in protecting those freedoms. I also want to hit something quickly to that the caller is getting at that you also raised, and that is, you know, this, well, there's really no threat here. Just keep in mind that there have been 300 anti-transgender and anti-LGBTQ bills proposed in state legislatures just in 2022. In the past 3 years, 20 new anti-transgender laws have become law. And so there's a whole host of issues related to abortion or to marriage equality and gender identity that are also going to be subject to state restrictions given the court's circumstances, you know, what the position that the court has taken here.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rebecca joins us now in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. I just had a quick question about how we could get more justices on the Supreme Court. I know that's always a discussion. They're always talking about it. Is it a, you know, a hard process for them to go through? And who decides if we can do that?
Rebecca, thanks for the call. The number 9, I don't think, is in the Constitution when it comes to the number of justices, Kimmy. That said, it's not easy peasy to change that number.
No, it started at 6, went up to 7, back to 6, up to 9, then to 10, back down to 9 in the late 1860s and has been held there since. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, tried to pack the court in the 1930s because the Supreme Court kept striking down what he thought were his perfectly good laws that Congress had passed. And it really didn't go anywhere, in part because two of the justices on the court began magically seeing FDR's position and began switching their votes. I don't think that's likely to change here, but I'm also very clear that it's Congress that makes those determinations. And I think that given the tenuous nature of where Congress is at and how divided we are, I don't see that happening. Both, you know, abortion, marriage equality, and changing the size of the Supreme Court all come back to the political will of Congress. And there's an argument to be made here. Congress doesn't have any spine, that Congress is avoiding these issues. And they like to talk the rhetoric when it serves them for come election time, but that the reality is until they are forced to deal with it, they're not going to deal with it. And that's why I think the Republican Party is going to have some difficult issues. So to get at your caller's question, the real issue you've got to get around is that on marriage equality, in terms of support, public opinion show that between 6 and 10 registered voters, and actually some polls say as high as 70%, with almost 35% of Republicans saying that they support marriage equality, is going to be difficult for hardcore, you know, very conservative folks to be able to get around, because they've lost in some ways the support of their party on the marriage equality issue. And that's a little different from what you see in the abortion case.
Kimmy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You betcha. As always, love that public radio.
Kimmy King is interim chair and distinguished teaching professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas. We talked to her today about proposed legislation known as the Respect for Marriage Act. The U.S. House passed a version that would confirm a right to marry for same-sex and interracial couples. That bill is now under negotiation over in the U.S. Senate. A Lake Superior tribe has been embroiled in a years-long legal battle with the Canadian energy firm Enbridge after it sued to remove the company's oil and gas pipeline from tribal lands. As a result, Enbridge is seeking permits to route its Line 5 pipeline around the Bad River Band's reservation. Now, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says a state review didn't fully account for ways that the project could harm the environment and tribal resources. Danielle Kading has more.
With the sun blazing, tribal and environmental advocates gather on a road where Enbridge's Line 5 crosses the Bad River Reservation. The pipeline carries up to 23 million gallons of Canadian crude oil and natural gas liquids daily from Superior to Sarnia, Ontario. The tribe's natural resources director, Naomi Tillison, says the tribal council rejected renewal of easements for the pipeline due to the threat of an oil spill.
That's why the council said we are not going to renew these because we need to protect our water.
While the tribe's case is ongoing, Enbridge wants to reroute around 40 miles of Line 5. Critics have already blasted a draft environmental review of the project conducted by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. They say there's not enough information to lawfully grant a permit, and EPA staff agree. The EPA's regional administrator, Deborah Shore, told WPR's The Morning Show they reviewed and offered input on the state's draft.
We think that many of the comments we provided to take climate change into account and to do a much more thorough review of the potential impact on tributaries and on those wetlands will assist in a better review.
The federal agency sent the DNR nearly 200 recommendations to strengthen its review. The Tyler Forks River cascades down to join the Bad River within Copper Falls State Park. EPA staff say the Line 5 reroute may have substantial and unacceptable impacts on the Bad River and the Caucagan Bad River sloughs. Overlooking the falls, Tillison says lake sturgeon spawn in the river and wild rice grows in the internationally recognized wetlands.
That's really, really important to the Bad River tribal members. It's part of the migration story where they migrated to find the food that grows on water, and that's wild rice.
The agency wants the DNR to show Enbridge's plans wouldn't negatively affect state and tribal water quality standards. The EPA also wants to see more details about the project's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions and how climate change could affect it. Walking through tall grass, a group treks into a wooded ravine where a creek runs under washed-out railroad tracks.
See the railroad tracks dangling in the air?
That's Joan Elias. She owns about 190 acres, and some of that land runs next to the project. Elias says after 10 inches of rain flooded creeks and rivers one night in 2016, she was temporarily stranded.
It was washed out along Little Edwards Road. It was washed out here.
Opponents say more frequent intense storms driven by climate change only increase the threat of an oil spill along the pipeline's route. Tribal members also fear the project will harm treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather. Lacouture tribal member Don White with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission points out Wisconsin made it a felony for people to go on an energy provider's property without consent.
For folks who just don't have a lot of resources, it is not in the best interests of tribes to diminish any sort of access.
The EPA doesn't have a lead role permitting the project, but the federal agency is coordinating with state regulators and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps says its goal is to resolve EPA's concerns. The DNR says they're addressing issues with those agencies as well as Enbridge. An Enbridge spokesperson maintains the company is committed to protecting the environment, and the Canadian firm stresses the pipeline is a vital energy link for the region. Business manager Joel Zilke with the local 601 Steamfitters Union agrees.
That's a lot of gas and diesel and propane for people that really rely on that, you know, at this point still.
Zilke also touted the 700 jobs the project would create, along with millions in state tax revenues. Enbridge plans to break ground once all permits are granted, but it's clear federal regulators want to know a lot more before they make any final decisions. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, tomorrow marks the anniversary of the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act back in 1990. Find out what led to the passage of the law and the impact it's had over the last three decades. Plus, a look at the challenges that still remain today with new lawsuits related to elections and other issues still in the works related to the ADA. Also on The Morning Show tomorrow, monarch butterflies are now endangered, according to an international wildlife organization. You can find out why and what everyday people can do to help, and if you've participated in one of the many local efforts aimed at preserving habitat for monarch butterflies, We'll want to hear from you. You can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Do you have some butterfly-friendly plants in your own backyard? If you work for a business or a city, say local government, that maintains some sides of highways, do you have some butterfly-friendly plants going on? Do you have a backyard milkweed farm like I do, sort of accidentally? That's all coming up tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra, legendary venue for football. Turned into Lambeau Field, the soggy tundra for a different kind of football this weekend. On Saturday evening, a sold-out Lambeau played host to two of the world's best soccer clubs, Manchester City from England and Bayern Munich from Germany, both champions of their respective leagues. Wisconsin fans and fans from all over put their best foot forward to welcome the European teams to the first ever soccer match held at Lambeau. Wisconsin's weather was not quite as welcoming, with heavy rains, which they played through, but lightning storms, which caused two delays and evacuations of the field and stands. I was lucky enough to be there. It was worth the delays and rain to see the best soccer playing I'll probably ever see in person in my life. Plus, I had a rain jacket, water-resistant shoes, change of clothes for the ride home. Final score, Man City 1, Bayern München 0, and Lambeau Field fans 1, Wisconsin weather 0. Both very spirited matches. I'm mostly dried off now. This is Central Time.